And my hot take is that any solution to the Oracle problem makes Bitcoin able to do anything that any other, protocol out there can do.
Yeah.
Like any solution to the Oracle problem does the trick. And furthermore, any interesting contract requires an Oracle. So if you put those two things together, it's like, why wouldn't you use Bitcoin for these things?
Yeah.
Conversations with the greatest minds in Bitcoin. This is a Bitcoin Audible chat. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. We've got an awesome guest today. We are diving all into some Bitcoin tech with Nadav Cohen from the Shurd Bits crew. They are a wonderful blog. This does get kind of technical because there's just so much cool stuff packed into this. So we kind of just went with it. If it does get a little overwhelming, know that I tried to, every once in a while when I would realize that it was kind of getting overwhelming, I tried to step it back and, get an analogy to try to help explain it and take a different perspective on it. Because Nadav was really getting into some deep stuff. But if you aren't super technical like a lot of us nerds, hopefully we can help illustrate how significant these are in layman's terms throughout the conversation. But Nadav talks about their work over at Shurd Bits, which is just an incredible team. And it is one of my main sources for serious breakdowns of a lot of this technology and what you can do with it. And we get into so much in this podcast. We've got DLCs, discrete log contracts. Get into a little bit of discussion of Taproot. We talk about point time lock contracts and some really major leaps that are coming to Lightning, both in security and privacy, and just so much more. But before we get into it, I just want to thank my two amazing sponsors who happen to have no association with BSV, whatever. That is Shift Crypto. They have got, they've got the best hardware wallet in the biz, the Bitbox O2. For your serious Bitcoin savings and a simple, reliable cold storage mechanism. Plus, they've got a lot of other great products in their store to assist with your cold storage. The Metal Seed Backup, they've got laminated backup cards, and just a lot of great tools to help keep your Bitcoin safe. Check them out at guyswan.com/bitbox. Then, of course, level.co, lvl.co, for your mobile banking services in Bitcoin and exchange. So you can hold your Bitcoin in your account, immediately convert to dollars for no fee whenever you need to make use of it. You've got direct deposit, a debit card, wire transfers, checks, and more. Check them out at guyswan.com/level. And a thank you to both of those wonderful teams for supporting the show. And if you would like to sponsor Bitcoin Audible, hit us up. Hit me up at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com if you've got a really cool Bitcoin product or service that you think our audience would find really interesting or needs to hear about, hit me up at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com. All right, without further ado, let's get into today's chat with Nadav Cohen, all about new tech coming to Bitcoin. Welcome to the show, man. It's awesome to have you on. I have been really wanting to pick somebody's brain about all of the tech coming, and like basically Shurd Bits is one of my absolute go-to resources for that kind of stuff, because y'all have the absolute best explanations and have detailed out some incredible stuff. And are you pretty big in Taproot? Like, have you been working with that a lot too?
Not in code. I've written a decent bit about Schnorr related stuff kind of on paper, and then I guess we have been working with Schnorr signatures for the purpose of DLCs, like for off-chain stuff. Mm-hmm. a decent amount, I guess I've also been writing a bit about like PTLCs, which will likely come in with Taproot as well. So kind of a bunch of tangential stuff, but we haven't yet started working on Taproot support internally on like Bitcoin S, but I assume that that's coming in some number of months. I don't know exactly when, but
all right.
Yeah.
Why don't we just start out? Give me your background, because I don't know that much about you other than that, like, you're one of the Sherd Bits guys. Sure. That's who I know. That's how I know you.
Yeah. So I joined Sherd Bits right out of undergrad. So I had graduated from the University of Iowa is also where Chris, the founder of Sherd Bits, graduated from. And so we met through a professor who we both had, who connected us, and just briefly chatted. He was still in Iowa City at the time. I knew nothing about Bitcoin, like at all. I skimmed the white paper the night before the interview. didn't have any time to absorb or look deeper. I was just like, okay, I think I get the like super high level. But I came in with this was 2018 May.
Okay.
So May 2018. I had a math and computer science background. I was a double major. Specifically my CS research during undergrad was in formal verification, which is like computer proofs of correctness for things. So like, as opposed to testing, you like prove that it's right. And then you don't have to worry about edge cases or anything like that. I mean, it's a lot more work, but, and it's not quite, user friendly yet to do, or, I guess engineer friendly is what really matters. But, So, that was kind of, so this is the professor who introduced me to Chris, was the professor I was doing research with. And me and Chris chatted for a while. He had me talk about, my interests in formal verification and other things like that. And I think he decided that I was like a paranoid enough programmer to cut it in like a Bitcoin space, just from my background. And then on top of that, at Sherd Bits, we use the Scala programming language, which is a functional programming language. And so I had that background as well, kind of from a programming languages, angle, as well as
Scholar?
Scala. So, Scala. Think like scalable Scala. It's the first couple letters.
Okay. Yeah. I have seen that.
Yeah.
I didn't know it by name or by sound.
It's a functional language kind of built on top of Java, but it's much nicer than Java. I didn't know the language, I didn't know Bitcoin, I didn't know any of that, but Chris decided take a little bit of a gamble, hire Nadav right out of college. I think I was the first software engineer hire at the time, so this was right when we were kind of ramping up at Sherd Bits. So at the beginning it was just kind of like me and Chris down in the basement of essentially the public library, right next to it in Iowa City. I was like bugging him 24/7 for like a couple weeks with questions because I knew nothing. My starting project was implementing the Bitcoin D RPC client in Bitcoin S in Scala. So I was learning the language. I was learning what you could do with Bitcoin Core, just kind of piece by piece. And then, at the end of a couple of weeks, I was like, okay, I think I get at a high level, it was like my full-time job to try and understand it. So, and then went off from there. But that's kind of how I got into Bitcoin. Not a very usual path in, I've noticed, but it's been fun. And then, I've been working at Sherd Bits ever since. May of 2018, we've been focused on a lot of more off-chainy kind of things. So we have Bitcoin S, which is our Scala library for Bitcoin, which does a bunch of stuff, and it's going to be a wallet soon as well. But we also work with a bunch of like Lightning stuff, and discrete log contracts are my main project right now. A couple other things as well.
Bitcoin S, explain this relationship to me. I mean, I think I know it, but just for simplicity and for the audience, you say Bitcoin S is a library, and it will be a wallet. Will that be by the same name, like Bitcoin S or something?
Yeah, it'll be the Bitcoin S wallet. So
library exactly.
Totally. Yeah. So it's kind of like it supports functionality. So you can use Bitcoin S in a couple different ways. To use it as a library, you would have to be programming in either Java or Scala. I guess the other alternative is if you have language bindings, you could bind to the library and use it in another language. Like we're trying to get it to work with JavaScript and some other things like that. But essentially, when I say library, I mean like it's a code base with kind of an external facing API, which stands for Application Programming Interface. And so essentially it exposes all of the kind of things it can do to programmers who can then use it to write their own software or whatever else they want to work on. And so we also are building a wallet on top of Bitcoin S, essentially in Bitcoin S, but kind of as a separate sub project. And then it also has a bunch of other stuff. So it is currently a pretty lightweight Neutrino node. So similar to like Wasabi, it is able to handle those BIP 158. Whatever that means. It's a light client. I guess the high level way of saying that. So it's a light client. It can handle blocks, block headers. It can build transactions, sign transactions, manage keys. It is a hot wallet right now, but we do want to introduce like HSM and hardware integration at some point. We put a bunch of stuff in there. It's got PSBTs. And so we use it for, it's open source. Anyone can use it for stuff, but we kind of use it for everything we do, including I'm building DLCs into Bitcoin S right now. So that's kind of where I'm doing my development for discrete log contracts. And we did some point time log contract demos in there. It's kind of just, it can do all the Bitcoin things. So we just build stuff in it and then find the right place to put it. It's quite an expansive project at this point, just for like general, like we support quite a long list of BIPs in Bitcoin S. And it's just a good library to pull out of when you're writing code.
So for an analogy, and this is kind of what I've pictured, because I've made use, but I don't, just for a simplified picture of it. Like, so a library is kind of like a set of like blocks of code in a sense. I think of it like, if we're talking about like Legos, is you've got like all your normal little like absolute base pieces that you can build stuff with. But then like a library would be like, okay, well, we built like a foundation and then there's a first floor and you're just going to grab the foundation fully built and the first floor fully built and stick those two together. And now we've got a building.
Yeah. Or another analogy might be like, we built the piano and then we just exposed the keys to you. So like you can play and all you have to worry about are these like 88 keys. But like, what we did is we, tied up all the strings and, carved it out.
Made the keys translate, each key translate to the actual note being played.
Exactly.
So all the instructions are behind the key.
Since it's in Scala, which is a language with a pretty strong type system, we also kind of built all this nice thing where like the key doesn't just do the thing. It also has like this nice assurances that like, it only accepts these kinds of inputs, will guaranteed only give you these kinds of outputs, etc. The kind of these kinds of things.
Cool. I like the piano analogy. I'll use that one going forward.
Yeah, that's my go-to interface.
All right. Now we can play Bitcoin S. And what are we going to be able to do with these keys? Maybe let's start with DLCs. I've not really covered DLCs in depth on the show, and they're a fascinating tool for a lot of different reasons. What are you most excited about or most interests you about DLCs? And what are they?
Well, I guess I'll start by saying the thing I or kind of my way into to working and thinking about DLCs even, was just, you know, I was interested in what it is you could do with Bitcoin, even from kind of more of a, like, you know, theoretical, you know, mindset. Like, you know, I'd learned about Bitcoin a while ago and kind of understood a good amount of it. I had been learning about Lightning. I'd read, I think, all but like one or two of the bolts at this point. And I'd started, you know, going back and forth on a couple of places on the mailing list, seeing all these cool things you can do, like coin swaps and amps on Lightning and all these other technologies where it seemed like you could actually, like, there was this kind of emergent, you know, a lot of people think about like what you can do with like Bitcoin versus like what you can do with Ethereum. And they just think at like the scripting level, and they think about how, right, all you can do in Bitcoin is like multi-sig and some other weird stack-based things that no one cares about, and lock times, I guess. Whereas like, you know, in Ethereum, you've got like the EVM and you've got kind of all this other stuff in terms of the actual language that you can put into a transaction. But then kind of, you know, the more I learned about Bitcoin, the more I saw that like really programming in Bitcoin is not so much about the scripting language. It's more about kind of this off-chain stuff that's going on. It's about having multiple off-chain transactions. It's about using time locks, hashes, and points in clever ways, kind of the scriptless scripts idea. I think Andrew Polstra, that's his name for these kinds of things. And then
it's basically the same thing as DLCs, right?
So I would say a DLC is a kind of scriptless script. Okay. Yeah.
And just for anybody listening, it's discrete log contracts, yes. Which is what DLCs is shorthand for.
Yeah, and it's a pun in the name. So discrete is spelled like private, like with two E's and then a T. But it's based on a discrete log, where that discrete would be spelled ET.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't realize.
It's a joke. It's a pun on the cryptography and the privacy features.
Oh my God, it's such a nerd joke.
Yeah, but it always.
I didn't even realize it wasn't spelled that way with discrete log.
Yeah, if I'm like typing in like Google Docs or something, it always tries to autocorrect it for me, which is quite annoying. But. Of like what Bitcoin can express in reality. You know, I was also learning cryptography at the time, so I was learning about kind of the tricks you could do there as well, and with, you know, zero knowledge proofs and all these other things where you can do stuff kind of off chain and then use the chain kind of just for like the bare minimum. And so essentially this is kind of the mindset I had going into DLCs, and I was also looking at some escrow stuff at the time. But I essentially, so I came across the DLC white paper. It was kind of inevitable that this would happen at some point if this is what I was looking at. It's very short. It's like 5 pages. And much of those 5 pages is like, it defines Schnorr signatures in there. And I'd not seen Schnorr signatures actually. So this was my first introduction to Schnorr signatures. And then also it was kind of like, at a high level, it was like, you know, we want to be able to do Oracle contracts on Bitcoin, where if you don't know, an Oracle contract is essentially just a payment that's contingent on a real world event of some kind. So say like, you know, the classic example is betting. You know, you want to put funds into a pot and then different people get different amounts depending on the outcome of like a horse race or, you know, a football game or something like this. To do this using Bitcoin, what you do is you have, or you require an oracle. So an oracle is essentially just some third party that broadcasts a signature of what happened. So they would say like either, you know, team A1 or team B1. Using that signature, we want to be able to kind of execute a contract or execute our payments essentially. So what we do is we set up, it's very similar to a Lightning channel in its setup, or a dual funded Lightning channel rather, where we both put funds in to a 2 of 2 multi-sig. So we have shared custody of this, but before we put those funds in, we also sign a bunch of transactions that spend from shared custody that we both agree to in advance. So essentially, once we've locked up our funds here, the only way that we can spend it without cooperating is using those transactions we signed previously. And those transactions we signed previously, there's one per event. So in this case, there's like a team A wins transaction and a team B wins transaction. And one of them sends all of the money, say, to you, and the other one sends all of the money, say, to me, in this kind of simple example. And then what we do is, so how we use the Oracle here is the
How much did we bet and what are we betting on?
Yeah. Let's make it concrete. So say, what's a sport that we could bet on?
We could bet on a football game.
Yeah. I always worry because, you know, what if there's an international audience? Like, who knows about American football? But whatever. It's not too important that it's American football here. So
let's do an election.
Okay. Yeah.
This is the big stink in everything, right? The
one we actually did. Yeah. So say, you know, Democrat win, Republican win in the American elections. What the Oracle would do ahead of time. Oh, and say, this was something that actually we did. So Chris put, or I think Nicolas Dorier, who works on BTC Pay Server, he put down, I think, 0.4 Bitcoin for Trump. And then Chris matched him on the other side for 0.6 on Biden. And essentially what happens there is they have this Oracle. In this case, there was an Oracle called Outcome Observer. Which was just on Twitter. They tweeted out like, hey, I'm going to be putting out a DLC signature on this event, and it's going to be one of these three messages. And it was Democrat win, Republican win, and other. And so then what Chris and Nicola did is they constructed, you know, their transaction where they put funds into a 2 of 2 multisig. They haven't signed it yet. They construct the three transactions for the possible outcomes, which is Democrat win, where Chris gets the one Bitcoin, Republican win, where Nicola gets the one Bitcoin, and other, where they each got refunded, I believe. And then there's also another refund transaction, but that's not important. Yeah. So then what you do is you give your counterparty signatures of all of these off-chain transactions, these secondary transactions. We call them contract execution transactions, or CETs for short, because it's a really long name. So these CETs, we have one for each possible outcome, and they correspond to that outcome. So they also have the payouts for that outcome, as you'd kind of expect. And then you have, so what you do is you sign them for your counterparty, but you can't just give them these signatures. Because if you give them the signatures, they can spend these transactions. So what you have to do is you have to verifiably encrypt your signatures. So what you do is you take the Oracle's announcement. So in the Oracle announcement, they have to give you some commitments, cryptographic commitments to the fact that they're going to be signing something in the future. And so specifically, these cryptographic commitments are just public keys. So they give you the Oracle's public key, and they also give you the public key associated with their, which is oftentimes just called the nonce, but it's a public key. Mm-hmm. So they have some secret that they use in say their signing, their signature nonce, which is a nonce. Anytime you hear that, it's like a one-time use pub key essentially. So they have a one-time use key that they're going to use for this event. And then they have their like normal Oracle. This is the key that identifies this Oracle key. And using those two keys and the possible messages that they might sign, you can compute public keys that you can use to encrypt things, where the decryption key is the signature. So this is actually just a nice property of Schnorr signatures, is that if you pre-commit your nonces, then people can anticipate, so to speak, your signatures, meaning that they can compute just from that public information. They can compute like a public key version of your signature, where what that means is that they can encrypt something using that public information, which can only be decrypted using the signature.
Gotcha. So in the context of like a lock, is that you've written a transaction with essentially like the public locks on it, and this Oracle, this company that's going to say whether or not the Democrat or the Republican won, has posted a public lock, and you can't know from looking at the lock what the key is, but basically they've designed it in such a way that after they publish another piece of information later, then you can get the key from it. And it's explicitly tied to whether or not Republican is in it or Democrat is in it.
So kind of essentially a
really simplified version.
Yeah. So essentially you can think there's like a bunch of these different padlocks on a bunch of different storage doors or whatever. And essentially what happens is that you have all of these different locks and you can't derive the keys from the locks, because that's the point of cryptography. And then and then what the Oracle does is it's at the time that it broadcasts what happened, essentially just like dumps, or they tweet out essentially like, here is the blueprint for the key that actually works, or the key that corresponds to what actually happened. And then anyone who wants to can privately, without interacting with the Oracle, just by going online, they can essentially like say 3D print this key and then go in and unlock exactly one of these doors, and all of the other doors remain locked. And the Oracle cannot broadcast more than one key, essentially, more than one signature of what happened. If they do, they actually leak their private keys. So they become like a useless non-Oracle, because
That's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yes. So that's actually built in to this scheme.
That's a cool safety measure that I didn't.
Yeah, and it's not even something that like work would had to be done for. It just kind of it's very natural, because if you sign two different messages with the same nonce, just in any signature scheme, you leak your keys. Like, it's very insecure. You can't have nonce reuse. So this is just like a consequence of nonce reuse in signing.
So it wasn't even designed. It was just kind of a
It was very natural.
Happened to work out that way, that they put themselves at risk if they cheat.
Yeah. So the Oracle can only ever give you one key to one of your transactions that you have off chain, these CETs. And this is how we make a Bitcoin transaction contingent on a real world event at a very high level. Now, to extend this to make it more general, because so far maybe you understand how it works for like, if there's three outcomes or something like that, but what if it's like a complicated outcome, and you know, what if I don't want to use just one Oracle or these kinds of things? So it is generalizable. You can do a ton with it. So we've figured out how to do kind of these general numeric outcomes. So say like, if you want to speculate on the Bitcoin price, which is what most people apparently want to do, you can do all sorts of things. You can have like, you know, call options. You can have these payout curves that are that look like I think the proper term for the shape is a hyperbola, but essentially think like you know, 1/x kind of shape of a graph, where these are useful. For example, if you want to do a contract for difference, this means that you put in some amount of Bitcoin into your contract, but then the amount you get out has the same USD value as the amount that you put in at that time. So yeah, you're kind of speculating like on the, it is exactly that, you know, the party that wants a fixed USD value is essentially shorting BTC USD, and their counterparty would be someone who wants to go long BTC USD. And then you can have that payout curve. And so we can do all sorts of these kinds of things using all sorts of clever tricks of cleverly slicing up our domain of possible outcomes. So the in reality, like the set of possible outcomes in these kinds of contracts is like all numbers between 0 and like 1,000,000 or something like that. But you don't want to have 1,000,000 contract execution transactions off chain that you have to encryptedly sign. Yeah, and all
keep
of this
up
stuff.
With.
Yeah, it's super impractical. But we have so we've been working on a bunch of optimizations, and it's down to like, it's almost always just like a couple thousand that are able to enforce this entire space. using gotcha. All sorts of fancy tricks that we've come up with. And that
so that's so actually a way to, I mean, like that's kind of the purpose of Forex markets and futures contracts is to be able to, you know, Apple is making a deal with some manufacturer or chip producer or whatever in China, and they don't know what's going to happen between the dollar and the yuan in the yeah. interim. You know, it might take a month, 2 months totally. To get through this deal. So they write, you know, a contract, and they do a big futures contract that says, I don't really care if the yuan or the dollar goes up in yuan terms, because I just want to be able to account for the fact that I made a deal relative to, you know, $30 million today. And in 2 months, I still want it to be $30 million. So exactly. this is actually a way to pull that off without even having a exchange mm-hmm. in the middle.
Yeah. So generally, people like to call these, I believe, synthetic assets. So essentially, you can have like these Bitcoin collateralized contracts that correspond to some fixed amount of some other thing, some other currency, mm-hmm. some other commodity, some other something. So essentially, as long as you have an oracle for this thing, say in this case, the various prices, I guess in this case, you would use BTC USD and BTC Yuan oracles together in some way, then you would be able to draw out exactly what needs to happen so that at the end of the day, you end up with a fixed amount of whatever currency it is that you want to have. Yeah, and actually, now that I'm thinking about it, you wouldn't need two oracles in this case. You just need one. If you have USD and you want fixed Yuan, you would use that USD to buy BTC and then immediately send that BTC into this contract yeah. and just use the BTC Yuan.
Both sides would only have to deal with their BTC exactly. to their currency ratio. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, you can, this is one of, I think, the more interesting applications that we already know of that a lot of people have thought about and have, you know, plans for, so to speak, is synthetic assets, especially once we put discrete law contracts on the Lightning Network. This is kind of the way to achieve synthetic assets on the Lightning Network, I believe. And specifically, there's kind of, so yeah, to go on a bit of a tangent about synthetic assets.
Real quick, okay, so when this is put on the Lightning Network, this means that you're holding this transaction in a Lightning channel, and even the execution of it is then off-chain.
Correct.
So all of this is essentially private in a sense that, you know, it's not publicly broadcast and kept on the chain. And then also it doesn't bloat the chain. So it's not going to be horribly expensive to constantly right. do this.
Exactly. Yeah. So like once we put this on Lightning, everything is off chain, like absolutely zero on chain footprint for a fully non-custodial arbitrary Oracle contract.
God, pretty, that's amazing.
Pretty awesome.
That's phenomenal. Yeah. So this is kind of like a layer three in a sense.
Kind of, I like to think of it. I personally think of layer two as being very expansive. So yeah. I like to think of it as kind of like just DLCs on main chain, just like on Bitcoin, is layer two ish. I mean, it's kind of, it blurs the line, but it's basically, I like to think of it as kind of this layer two, meaning that like your actual contract isn't written in script. It's written in like MetaScript or whatever. It's like written via having multiple transactions with different things on them, kind of in the same way that the Lightning Network has that. Mm-hmm. And then, but the nice thing is, you know, because they're so simple, like if you look at the on-chain footprint of a DLC, like what you actually need the underlying ledger to do in order to let you do DLCs is it's literally just like signature validation and multi-sig, like those are the two, and I guess time
and locks a time lock
if you basically want a refund transaction. But if you don't want a refund transaction, you don't even need a time lock. Like you can even use oracles as time locks if you really want to.
That's interesting. I didn't think about that.
Because so that's another cool thing. Yeah. You can have a time oracle. And so, you know, they have to have broadcasted a certain signature saying this time has passed before you can do something. You can do all sorts of cool things like that. Yeah, go ahead.
What's the incentive for an oracle to play this game? You know, like what would it be to have the NFL publish a public key and you know, do a signature, like do this setup so that other people could take bets that didn't require them to, you know, go to the NFL website and place bets with them.
Yeah. So there's a couple different
Not ways. That the NFL has like betting sure. on their website, but you get what I mean.
Yeah, no, we have a decent amount of like NFL data that we have APIs to sell it over Lightning actually. So that's a fun example. But so essentially there are a couple different ways this could go. One is that, you know, you could just have someone who wants, or so I should say, before I say any of this, being a DLC Oracle is not hard. So because of how the DLC model works, which I can get more into soon, the goal is for the Oracle to be oblivious. I like to call them oblivious oracles, in part because of the alliteration. But an oblivious oracle essentially is just an oracle who has one job, and that's to be an oracle. They don't communicate with users if they don't have to, or shouldn't know who their users are. They don't know what their users' contracts are. They aren't required any interaction in order to execute contracts. They can't look on chain at these executed DLCs and see that they've been used. They can't see anything. They're like blind. And if your Oracle is oblivious, then certainly your bystanders are also going to be oblivious, because the Oracle knows even more than them, right? They have their own key. They know the private keys and all these other things that other people don't know. Yes, so we want oblivious Oracles. And what that means is that all an Oracle does is it publishes these announcements saying, I'm going to sign these things. And then it signs those things and it publishes those attestations or signatures. And that's all there is to it. Like, you know, it's like a simple wallet. It's simpler than a wallet because it doesn't really have to keep track of funds, right? It's keeping track of keys is why it's similar to a wallet. But it's a wallet that just keeps track of like your keys and some messages that you might sign. And then you tell it what to sign, either programmatically using like APIs, if you're just rebroadcasting a DLC compatible signature of like, say, I don't know, BitMEX's exchange rate, you could do that programmatically without actually having a person involved. Or you could literally just, if it's like a daily event or something, you could just have someone daily go in there and say what happened. So anyway, running an Oracle, very simple. We already have open source Oracle software. Ben Carman wrote this thing called Crystal Bull, which is essentially what I talked about. It's like a wallet for your in that it stores keys, and in no other way is it a wallet. I should stop calling it a wallet. It's a keyring, essentially, right? It's an Oracle keyring that lets you kind of do these Oracle signatures and announcements and all of these kinds of things. And I should mention, just so no one gets confused, I remember earlier I mentioned that we're using Schnorr signatures. The Oracles in a DLC currently use Schnorr signatures, but on-chain, it doesn't require on-chain Schnorr.
That's the off-chain. They can essentially use any signature scheme they want, because all they're doing is revealing the piece of data needed to unlock it on-chain. So
exactly. Yeah. The only thing that's required is that you have this anticipation property, which Schnorr signatures do have.
Okay.
Which is one of the reasons why we're using them. By giving your public information, people can build all of these locks, which your signature will unlock one of them. That's kind of the one property you need. But other than that, everything else is the same. On-chain, we're still using ECDSA. So this works today. We're executing all of these things on mainnet today. I guess I wanted to say that. But so now I've talked a bit about running an Oracle, super simple. If you want to do more complicated things, it can get a little complex. But at the end of the day, it'll never be more than just like generating keys, broadcasting announcements, broadcasting signatures.
Could this be a situation where the Oracle basically gave, like, let's say I ran an Oracle.
Yeah.
And technically I could, you know, it's open source. And,
totally.
You know, I would just build a reputation based on whether or not, you know, I published a signature that said Trump won when that wasn't the truth. You know, but in that instance, is that if I do that, is that something where I can literally just put it behind an API and charge you know, do the something like the that little Sea Lightning pay by API or whatever, and yes, charge a penny.
So that's
every
that's,
time somebody uses it.
This is one of the main routes for kind of monetizing oracles is paying over Lightning, because it's just so. I mean, it's not just that we love Lightning. You
know, it fits. It works.
it works. It's the key thing is that it is a private payment. So in Lightning, you have the property that the person being paid does not know who it is that originated the payment. So when you're paying over Lightning, it's onion routed. It's essentially a similar technology to like the dark web. And, you know, on the dark web, websites don't know the IP addresses of their clients, right? Or of the people who are accessing the website. So it's very similar on Lightning. It's onion routed. The person getting paid doesn't know who the person paying them is. And then furthermore, you have this kind of receipt associated with your payment on the Lightning network that's atomic with the payment going through. So either the payment fails somewhere, in which case it fails everywhere, or it goes through everywhere along the route. You know, Alice pays Bob, pays Carol, pays Dave, and all of them either fail or all of them work. And if all of them work, then atomic with that, you also get the receipt, which is this hash pre-image. So you get the secret that acts as a receipt over the Lightning network. Lightning network has receipts, and you can use that kind of as like an encryption key, so to speak, where you give them the encrypted data. And so then if they pay, then if and only if they pay, they get their data. And in this case, the data being like that signature. And in the future, you know, once we have Taproot, once we have PTLCs, once we integrate PTLCs into Lightning, whatever those are, that's a tangent for later, maybe.
We'll get there in just
but,
a second.
Yeah. Once we have that stuff, you can actually do this in a very trustless way, where you can be guaranteed that the pre-image, your proof of payment, your receipt, is exactly the signature of this message by this oracle, requiring any kind of fancy stuff. But anyway, yeah. So in the future, especially, I mean, today you can do it since you're already trusting the oracle. You can do it where you just trust them that like the thing you pay for isn't just random garbage. And if it is, you know, you can like, I don't know, make some noise about it. But yeah, so one of the routes is monetizing over Lightning. I think this makes a lot of sense. I would be very surprised if this wasn't one of the primary ways that oracles, at least in the short term, are monetizing. Another route.
And the funny thing is that this is actually lends to an opportunity for regulatory arbitrage too, in a sense, because, you know, if gambling is not legal in the country or whatever that this oracle exists in, the oracle is not facilitating gambling. Like they're not a platform for people to gamble on. They're literally paying for just access to get a piece of information, like to just get a broadcast that this guy won the fight, and you know, Mayweather won the fight, not the other guy. And I didn't execute any of these contracts. I don't even know who my customers are. Like I just said that and I signed it. Like, how could you claim that I've let somebody else? Or I've gambled for somebody else. I've been running a betting platform.
Yes, exactly. It certainly makes the argument harder. I won't. You know, you should.
It's a gray area.
If you're in one of these places, yeah. If you plan on making it big and like this is your life's goal is to be in Oracle service, you should probably hire a lawyer or learn some law related to this. And I don't know exactly. I'm not the best person to ask about the regulative side of being a DLC Oracle, but as far as Oracle protocols go out there, this is like the best one from this perspective by far. You know, if you look at like how Ethereum normally does oracles via like federation, it's very hard to claim like, no, I'm not enabling this, when it's like, if you want to use this betting platform, you must use this oracle. Where this is very much not the model that DLCs follow. With DLCs, you get to choose your own oracles. Those oracles don't even know you exist or that you've used them or how you've used them, even after the fact. And furthermore, and I alluded to this earlier, you can use multiple oracles. So you can do kind of the multi-sig of oracles. You can do 2 of 3 oracles. You can do 3 of 5 oracles. You can use multiple oracles. You can use the oracles you want to use. And
that would be a mitigation of like, let's say I was a you know, an asshole. And I said, Trump won because MAGA and for life, Q, all good things, patriots. And then, you know, somebody was like, well, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to, you know, you just screwed up my deal. Well, they can use a 5 of 7 multi. Yeah,
well, and they would have had to do that ahead of time before
sure,
they knew.
Sure,
that
sure, sure.
But yes, yeah. This is exactly right. So if they'd used a 2 of 3 and the other two oracles did say Biden, then they would still be able to execute Biden. And not only that, they would then, you know, broadcast far and wide fraud proof out for you, because what you did is you didn't just lie. You like published a signature using your Oracle keys of a lie, right? That's just like instant proof to everyone that they shouldn't use you. So it's not just these people who won't use you. It's everyone who won't use you now.
It's not like a politician gets to walk it back and be like, well, I really admit this. And then, you know, just push it all.
The semantics are quite precise here. And the commitments are cryptographic. So there's no walking it back. If you ever do anything bad, there is proof of it. And that proof is very compact and very shareable between clients. Fraud proofs is another piece of the puzzle when it comes to how DLCs handle the Oracle problem. So we want oblivious oracles, and we want oblivious oracles who are very accountable and can't undetectably cheat in any way. So there's lots of ways in which this happens. One of them is that their keys get leaked if they sign multiple messages. And if their keys get leaked, you can sign a special message saying like, I'm compromised. You know, anyone can sign that message and push that around, and then everyone can use that. And even if they want to, they could time lock all of their CETs and have one non-time locked transaction for the I've been hacked, that like refunds or something like that.
Oh,
you could
do these kinds of things. I didn't think about that.
There's all sorts of things you could do. It's kind of up to what you want to do, how much, you know, if you trust your counterparty, it matters less because it's a 2 of 2, you can do anything you want. Normally, you know, untrusted parties, you just decide in advance what you want to do with all these situations. And this is just taken care of course, by the software. You don't have to like go in and hack this yourself. But so with these DLC oracles, you know, what we ask of them is very little, but we, you know, hold them to account, and they can't do anything else essentially. Like there's no way that they can like try and cheat in a way where they'll like dox you or something like this.
Yeah.
At least not very easily. Go ahead.
Go ahead and finish the other thing.
Yeah, I was just going to say, with these kind of thresholds of oracles, it makes it, it has a lot of benefits. It's not just that, you know, you're protected from a lying oracle, but because of the fact that fraud proofs are so oracles as like unsustainable, right? Like no one's going to use you after that. And so essentially, if you look at kind of just the incentive for oracles, like even if someone's bribing them, this oracle has no way of knowing that you're not part of like a 7 of 13 contract where you're trying to bribe 7 oracles. And if any one of them doesn't, you know, follow through, then the other 6 oracles get screwed and essentially like lose their livelihoods as oracles.
It's so kind of a reverse prisoner's dilemma again.
Yeah.
In a situation where you can only lose and the possibility of winning is extremely slim.
So you have to pay in advance essentially if you want to bribe credibly. And not only do you have to pay in advance, but you have to pay like a bunch of actors in advance now that we're using multiple oracles. And you know, the cost is not how much do you get for this one contract. The cost is like, and the opportunity cost of not being able to use those keys anymore.
Yeah. So basically throwing your reputation in the trash and losing all the foundation of your business and everything that you actually built up with this.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So this is the Oracle model under DLCs, is you pick your oracles, you can use multiple. They don't know anything about you. They're oblivious. They don't see your contracts in any way. That's kind of our solution to the Oracle problem, so to speak, which I think is better than anything else I've seen out there. And, even cooler because it requires so little. You can use this anywhere. Like ETH can use DLCs. They can even use DLC oracles that Bitcoiners are using. Like there's no on the only on-chain requirements here are like multi-sig and signatures, like which I guess is part of multi-sig. Like you need multi-sig, and if you have multi-sig, you're good. And you can do DLCs pretty much anywhere you want, and you can do them with the same oracles. The oracles are blockchain agnostic. They're protocol agnostic. I can use them for Lightning, Bitcoin, anything.
Yeah, in the same way that you can use Schnorr, even though Bitcoin doesn't have Schnorr, doesn't matter. Like you just need the piece of data.
Right. DLCs are kind of this off-chain phenomenon.
And in that same sense, the thing I was going to ask just a minute ago was that this is also application agnostic. Like you can essentially run any application that you want. I mean, just in the same way that you can use Schnorr signatures, whether or not Bitcoin has it, mm-hmm. is that you can have this whole off-chain thing that you're just, you have to run this, you know, process that's got like 800 different branches and this huge complex thing. And I can run it and the Oracle can run it at the same time, just so that we know the output is accurate. And Bitcoin doesn't have to know anything about what's going on.
Yeah, nothing touches chain. And yeah, oh, and I should mention, so yeah, you can use it on Bitcoin. Any place where you can do multi-sig, that's the only thing you really need in order to route stuff on chain. Multi-sig, and I guess transactions. You need to be able to do transactions.
You need transactions.
Yeah.
Damn it.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, you could probably even, I don't know anything about Ripple. You could probably do this there. I don't know. yeah, essentially it's one of its nice properties is that, and I alluded to this, if the oracles are oblivious, then certainly bystanders are as well. So your on-chain transactions are super indistinguishable from other things. I mean, these days it's a two of two multi-sig on-chain, right? But it looks very similar to a Lightning channel. And furthermore, you know, it leaks nothing about your actual contract when you're done. And in the future, once we have Taproot, all of these two of two multi-sigs become single keys, right? Mm-hmm. So once we have Taproot, the DLC footprint is literally a transaction with a couple inputs and a couple outputs, right? There's the funding and some change. And then the next transaction is like one input, at least two outputs, and that's it. But it's like all of it is single keys everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so that could just be like a transaction with change. It's not necessarily that it's splitting between two people, right? So yeah, especially once we have Taproot, these things are like indistinguishable from normal activity on Bitcoin. And they do very general things. And on top of that, as we mentioned with integrating them with Lightning, I like to think of DLCs as something more like a building block, right? You can use this with other protocols. It's a way of making payments contingent on things oracles say. So, you know, that's just like, add that into your toolbox that already has multi-sig and time locks and hash locks and point locks. Now you have oracle locks as well. And you just throw that into your toolkit and move on and build stuff on top of that as well.
That is awesome. So I've recently had a few people I know personally who invested in Bitcoin just before this major run-up, and they've really been riding a rocket down the rabbit hole. So I was just having a convo with somebody who was just like, I need to run a node. I got to get on Lightning. Do I need a Raspberry Pi computer? What hardware wallet? All this crazy stuff. And I'm like, slow down. The first and most important thing you need to do is secure your savings by holding your keys. You need a secure, easy-to-use hardware wallet. That is the Bitbox O2. It is actually co-founded by a Bitcoin developer, and the team is made up of serious engineers. It is Swiss-made. It's a sleek, simple design. The backup is as simple as plug in your SD card, hit the backup button, take it out. The wallet software is super minimal, and it just works. If you have started investing, get a Bitbox before it turns into a ton of money and keep your Bitcoin safe. Check it out at guyswan.com/bitbox. Yeah. And y'all have basically done this. Y'all did a couple of these already.
We merged Oracle multi-Oracle support in yesterday. So now we've got kind of the full feature set more or less.
Oh, wow. So this is basically ready to go?
Give me a month or two to like test it and document it and get the other implementations up to speed, and maybe clean up some of the specifications with more examples and stuff. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, if you really wanted to, and you were savvy enough, you could pull down my code and run it and execute DLCs, because that, I mean, we're doing this on main chain. Like we do an experiment at this point, at least once a month, sometimes once a week. We're like, new kind of contract, let's go. And then we just do it on chain internally in SugBits. We did a contract for difference on main chain a couple weeks ago. And before that, me and Chris executed a volatility contract on main chain and all these kinds of things. And yeah, every time we get a new bit of features, we're like, okay, let's go main chain right away. I mean, we have some tests, but yeah. And then coming up, hopefully me and Ben will be executing a multi-Oracle CFD on chain. So that'll be the next fun thing we do. And that should be soon-ish.
What do you think the first applications for this? I mean, do y'all plan on running or being an Oracle or something to start off with?
So actually, there already have been DLCs out in the wild. So there's a company called Atomic Finance. And they had an application that ran a market for DLCs on the US election. And this was ongoing for quite a while. And they had a nice website. I think that they got a bunch of like the big people on Twitter, like Pierre Richard and all these other people to come and like just put things on the book, essentially. Like, here are the odds, here's the amount, and then anyone could take. And then it was just kind of like this lightweight browser wallet, web wallet that you would put funds into. It was non-custodial, which is great, but it was like you had to move funds into this web wallet, which, you know, in the future won't be the case, hopefully. But regardless, it had this nice interface and, you know, it was very smooth. We used it. We played around with it as well. And then all of those, I assume in the coming days are going to be executed. And those are all just on-chain DLCs that actually happen. So this is like, some stuff has already been built with it. Because on the specification side, so I should say there is a big specification effort, for DLCs. I lead kind of these monthly meetings with a bunch of people, all over the world. We've got people from Crypto Garage over in Japan. We've got Lloyd Fournier, who is out of Australia, and he I believe is funded by Square Crypto, and he's just kind of an independent developer working on a bunch of stuff, DLCs being one of them. He's the one actually who figured out how to do these verifiably encrypted signatures using ECDSA. Everyone knew how to do it with Schnorr already. These are also called adapter signatures, if you've ever heard of these. Adapter signatures are just these verifiably encrypted signatures. So he's writing a specification right now for adapter signatures on ECDSA, which DLCs are using. Anyway, there's a big spec effort. I can share the link for the repo if you want to throw that in the show notes.
Yeah, actually, that'd be great for the show notes, yeah.
Yeah. A bunch of activity. Essentially right now, things are nearing stable, but not quite there. And so part of the reason that you haven't seen as much out in the wild is because things on the Oracle side of things are going to be like pretty completely stable in a month or two. And we're going to be like tagging like a V0 or something like this. Mm-hmm. And then once that's done, Oracles can like publish saying like, I'm going to say what the Bitcoin price is in 10 years on this day or something like that. And we don't want people doing that before we have a completely stable Oracle interface, because it's a huge pain if you have open events that haven't been signed yet to do this migration. It's possible. It's just a pain. So we want to save people from that. And that's part of the reason why this election bet was such a great use case for the time, is because it ended very soon.
Very quickly. Yeah.
So it used a kind of an old version of DLCs, but it still worked. And the newer version is better. And more stuff to come, I'm sure, from the guys over at Atomic Finance. And
question on DLCs on Lightning real quick.
Yeah.
Is that when you're doing that, like, let's say it's like a month before the election and I write this transaction, does that then mean that I'm basically, like, let's say my route to you is through Bob. Does that mean that we're locking up money with Bob for that month and I'm essentially paying for one of the holdable HTLCs or whatever that will let him, you know, pay him an interest rate essentially for holding that money?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways to put DLCs on chain, DLCs on Lightning off chain. One of them that I think will be first is to put them directly in channels. So sure. Essentially, yeah. You use your channel as a ledger in this two-person universe. It's like its own blockchain almost. Mm-hmm. Not exactly, but it has a similar interface and it has the same script mechanism, same enforcement rules. As Bitcoin, so you build it using the same Bitcoin tooling to build all these off-chain transactions off of your channel, so on and so forth, kind of acts like you'd think it would within a Lightning channel, but this only enables DLCs between two parties. I think this will be particularly useful for synthetic assets because how synthetic assets work is that, you know, at the end of the day, everyone's using Bitcoin, but certain people have price exposure to something else instead of Bitcoin. And so, right, if I'm paying over the Lightning Network and I have like a USD channel or a USD denominated channel, the person who I'm paying still gets sats, right? Maybe they also have a USD denominated channel, but if they do it, that's between them and the person next to them on the route, right? But at the end of the, so the translation, it's kind of like the back end is Bitcoin all the time, but then like only the last step on either side might be synthetic still. So for those kinds of applications, in-channel DLCs, I think make the most sense, in part because you don't have to worry about this exact problem of like locking up funds of all these things, of all these people in between. Now, there's a bunch of nuances there. I don't think they're worth going into right now. The other way of doing DLCs is this routed way. I have figured out how to do this using PTLCs. So I don't believe that I know how to do this on the current Lightning Network. So I do. It requires a bunch of zero knowledge proofs between like a bunch of people. So it's not worth it.
much more difficult to work.
Yeah, it's more difficult than say implementing Taproot-based Lightning channel.
okay, well on that, let's go ahead and get into PTLCs.
Okay.
So currently, a hash time lock contract is basically that there's a hash of a secret that the receiver has. I am sending you a payment. You send me the hash of the secret. You send me the fingerprint of the secret. And I lock a payment to Bob and then to you with the fingerprint of that secret. And as soon as you reveal the secret, it unlocks it to Bob and then Bob unlocks it to me. And you know, that cascades, the payment goes through. But the key about hash time lock contracts is that it's obvious between you and Bob and me and Bob that we're using the exact same fingerprint. That is the same
obvious to Bob, yeah.
Or obvious to Bob, yes.
Yeah.
And to anybody else who can maybe see, like they know that, okay, the one that I sent to Bob is also the exact same one as that Bob sent to you.
Yeah, and the nice thing is that all of these checks are just local, right? If you're routing a payment, you just want to make sure that the incoming and the outgoing have the same hash is the only thing you care about, right? Because that means that you're never going to be the one with the bill, right? You can always, either nothing happens or you can pass it on to someone else. That's the thing you care about as a routing node.
But then PTLCs don't quite work the same way.
Yes, so they work in a
how are they different
way.
And why?
So essentially they have a very similar functionality to HTLCs, but they're better in a couple different ways. So I'll start with just what's one problem with HTLCs or hash time lock contracts. So it's actually exactly what you just mentioned. You have to use the same hash everywhere. That's like the biggest downside of HTLCs. Reason being, it's terrible for privacy. Like it causes what we call payment correlation. There's already, even if there wasn't a way to literally tag payments with a hash that was common between places, You would still say, I mean, there's still things to worry about, just like there is on like Tor, right? You have to worry about like timing and size of packets and all of these kinds of things. And there are mitigations for all of those. But anyway, right now in Lightning, it's just like, we have this big problem. Before you think about any of those things, you have to think about the fact that anytime you're routing something through the network, it has a hash associated with it that's unique. Yeah. That like, you know, if two people along the route are actually the same person and they see that hash twice, they know that this payment came from this area of the network and went to this area of the network. So it's bad in that sense. It's also bad because it enables these things called wormhole attacks, wherein if this exact scenario happens where two nodes are communicating with each other, maybe because they're the same person, two routing nodes along a route, see that they have the same hash, rather than doing the normal thing when the payment completes of just passing the pre-image back on this way, they can kind of skip over everyone in between them and give it from one person over here in the route to this person all the way over here in the route. And by doing this, they steal all of the routing fees of everyone in between them and keep their funds locked up. So they can just grieve them as if it was a failed payment. And it's indistinguishable from a failed payment to all of the nodes in between. There's because no way of detecting these.
Yeah.
It acts just as if the payment failed, even though the payment succeeded, they just didn't get their cut.
The receiver and the sender, everything went through fine, but they gypped everybody in the middle because they managed to privately, in a completely different way, translate, you know, they sent a Telegram message. This is a secret. Don't tell those guys in the middle and we'll get
there. Or if it was one server running both nodes, even better. It's just doop. exactly. So that's a problem with HTLCs, is that you have these wormhole attacks and they're very properly incentivized. Like you're going to want to do these wormhole attacks. They run your competition out of business, right? This is part of the motivation. So this is kind of the negative side of the motivation. The positive side is you can do a bunch of stuff with PTLCs that you can't do with HTLCs, at least as easily. So, but the first thing is like HTLCs have this problem. How do we solve it? So intuitively, what we want to do is we want to use a different hash everywhere, right? So how do you do that? Well, the thing I've been mentioning about zero knowledge proofs, you could like prove that this is the tweaked version of this hash or something like that each time you go along and do some kind of weird cryptography there, but no one wants to do that. So luckily there's a better way. So what you can do is instead of using hashing like SHA-256, for example, you could instead, as your hash function, use elliptic curve points. So essentially, before your eyes glaze over, listeners, literally all I mean is like, you know how you have a private key and then you generate a public key from that and your public key gives no information about your private key? It has the same property as a hash in that it's a one-way function. You can't reverse the process. But as we all know, you can do a bunch of other stuff with keys. You can sign, you can do all sorts of other stuff, but they still have this one-way feature about them. So if you use kind of public key function, however you want to think about it, points is what they actually are, which is why we call this point time lock contracts. If you use points as your hash function and then do the same thing, now we have kind of more things we can do. So now you can add two points together, and that now corresponds to the point associated with the addition of the two secrets of those two points. So taking this back to like public key, private key world, which I think people are more comfortable with, you know, in the future, under Taproot, for example, if you have a two of two multisig, that's just going to be one key. And how you get that key is you combine the two public keys together. It doesn't require anything more than that. It doesn't require some kind of use of the private keys in some fancy way to generate this aggregate key. Essentially, the idea is you can use these aggregate points to tweak along the route and to do it in a way that can be verified without zero knowledge proofs that are hard and fancy. You essentially, what you do is you're like, here was the point before, here's the point after, and here's the secret I used to go from here to here, like the secret I added, the tweak that I added to it. And then, so each person knows only their own tweak. And so each hop along the route has a different point, a different hash, if you want to be sloppy about language, which a lot of people in the literature are. And some people still call these HTLCs, which I personally find confusing, but I get it, whatever. Because at the end of the day, the point is a hash. It's just a lot more than that too. A hash in the sense that it's a one-way fingerprint of the previous secret.
For an analogy of this, so it's kind of like, whereas in the hash time lock contract, in the current setup, is that you're using the same fingerprint for each hop.
Yeah.
And therefore, if you're hop four and hop two, there's no reason for you to go back to hop three. You can just scoot right around and give it the number two and pretend that that person doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
Whereas in the point time lock contract is that each hop is a new fingerprint and it's being added to the previous one. Yeah. So kind of like
contributing a secret.
Yeah. So kind of like how like onion routing is, you know, I have an envelope that has a destination on it, and then I open it or I send it to them. Then they open it. There's another envelope with another destination. They send it the next, they open it again, you know, the onion layers.
Exactly.
They see the next step. And this is that for the lightning payment for the key to unlock it. So everybody can only see the next step fingerprint. And therefore, four can't skip it to two without getting the fingerprint for number three along the way.
And on top of all of that, we get to keep the nice property that locally, all you have to care about, previously it was that the hashes were the same so that you don't end up with the bill. Now it's that the points are tweaked by a secret you know, right?
Yeah,
so that you can untweak it. Like that's the only thing you care about. And then it has this macro property, like you mentioned, that now you can't skip anyone. You need everyone. And not only that, so that mitigates the wormhole attacks, but also you just have better privacy, right? You can't tell if you're these two nodes along the route. They can't even know that this is the same payment. I mean, they can guess maybe depending on amounts and timing and all the other things that you have to worry about when it comes to onion routed networks. But at the end of the day, like if there are two distant nodes and they see these two different payments, especially in a world where we're using amps, so all payment denominations are relatively small and things like this, they won't even know that those two payments are related. So we call this payment decorrelation is the property that we get from these PTLCs because they're different points and different times and different places. You know, previously, the reason that they knew that they were along the same route is because the hash was the same. And then they used that to exploit this other problem. But now they not only can't they exploit it even if they knew, but they don't know. Which is another great benefit there.
So not only can they not skip three because they don't know three, they have no idea that four and two are related because they don't know three.
Yes, exactly. That's how it is. So so this is kind of the way in to PTLCs. So hopefully, what I mean by that is if this was all we got from point time lock contracts, I think it would be enough. Like definitely, we should do it this way. But it just so happens we get like so much more from using point time lock contracts. So first of all, another property here that's nice.
One quick question before we get into all the other cool ass stuff we can do with it. Does this need Taproot or anything? Or can we?
So it needs adapter signatures.
But we can do those with ECDSA.
Previously believed that we needed Schnorr for. We now know we can do it with ECDSA, but it is still worth noting that the ECDSA version is inferior to the Schnorr version. It's 162 byte adapter signatures versus 64.
60 or 64?
Okay. Yeah.
That's a big difference.
A little slower. And but the biggest thing is that it's bigger. And the reason why is because it has a little ZKP in there, which is 97 bytes. and then the rest is just a normal signature. But luckily, the ZKP is like the simplest possible one. Like even I read through it the first time and understood it, which not that that means that readers or, you know, normal people necessarily can do that. But I personally, I'm like in the middle there where I'm like, I can understand some things and not others. And this is like the easiest possible ZKP that you could hope for. So and this is what's required in order to do ECDSA adapter signatures. And luckily, it's actually already in production use, this particular ZKP. is called a DLEC proof, discrete log equality proof. But in Bitcoin, we're weird. We don't use the academic term for which is DLEC proof. We call them poodles, which is proof of discrete log equality.
Cloud or
we call them poodles, and they've been in production and join market since join market has been out there, and they're used for something else there. But yeah, we essentially literally just took poodles, and then that's kind of the only new thing you need in order to do adapter signatures on ECDSA. But for a myriad of reasons, the primary one being that this is so new, like we only knew this very recently that you could do it using ECDSA, there aren't any real plans to have PTLCs on Lightning before Taproot, because everything's going to be redone for Taproot anyway. We don't want like the intermediate step necessarily. That said, there are proof of concepts being built on today's Lightning using ECDSA adapter signatures, but it's not going to be widely deployed, I don't believe.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to invest in it when you'll have the simpler and lower cost solution.
I personally, I'm on the fence on that point, but I understand that like people who are working on Lightning and that's what they're working on, like this is kind of out of the way, and there's, they might as well wait for Taproot. I personally think it would still be worth it if we implemented PTLC stuff today, but I'm very biased, seeing as like that's the stuff I want to see exist as possible. No patience here, but I understand totally why this isn't gonna happen I'm working on DLCs. I can't do it, so I can't expect other people to do it. They're working on stuff too, but we'll get PTLCs when Taproot channels are around. This is a non-contentious change for the Lightning Network. I believe everyone is on board with PTLCs just generally. And the only thing that hasn't been done is rewriting a Lightning Network node, which, I shouldn't say the only thing, like that's quite a big thing. I think I previously posted to the Lightning Dev mailing list being like, here's the current status of what we know about PTLCs, how we could do them today, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, the only thing that would have to change is this, and change the state machine. And then like, I got a response from like Roast Beef being like, I wouldn't say the only change. This would constitute the biggest change the Lightning Network has ever undergone. And I was like, ugh, you're right. Darn. Some work to be done, but it's totally possible and it's popular and we'll probably get it with Taproot. It can do a lot more than payment decorrelation, though, which
that's awesome.
I'd be happy to get into. And I guess the first thing, though, which is still related to stuff we've already talked about, is I mentioned that you get this receipt over the Lightning Network, which is useful for things like if you want to monetize an Oracle and sell some data over Lightning. So this receipt today, it's just the pre-image to the hash we've been talking about. So it's not really a payment receipt. It's a part of a payment receipt. Like, to do things today on Lightning, which people are doing, you need like, and you need to know a public key from the user or something like this, because everyone along the route gets this pre-image, right? Like they could pretend they paid for it and claim like whatever it is that, or if you were thinking about like, say you're selling tickets to an event over the Lightning Network and the ticket is literally this payment pre-image, the pre-image to this hash. Well, you can't do that because now like every time you sell a ticket, if it's a route of 10 people, you just sold the same ticket to 10 people, on accident. Yeah. Whereas now, since every single hop is different and only the payer learns the actual pre-image without all the nonsense added on, without all these tweaks, it's an actual proof of payment. Like it proves that if you know the secret, you're the person who originated the payment and was actually footed with the bill. You didn't pass it on to someone else using a tweak.
So interesting. So in the current sense, you need the public key of the person you sent it to, and
our public key, I should say, not necessarily like their Lightning ID. Yeah, you just need like something from them that only they know the secret to. Exactly.
Gotcha. And but with the point time lock contracts, the point itself is basically all of it.
Yeah, the pre-image to the point is going to be an actual proof of payment, like a proper one. That you can use on application layers much more broadly and without worrying as much about all these other things. And then on top of that, you have this nice property that it's like, it's a point that you're using. And so you're paying for the pre-image to a point. So if that point happens to actually like mean something, or like it's not just some random number, say it's like the anticipation point to an Oracle signature, then you can be guaranteed that if you give up funds, you receive the signature, right? Like exactly that signature, because you verify that that point corresponds to the thing you want the pre-image for. So you gain information about the pre-image, not information that you can use to claim the payment, right? It's still a one-way function. But unlike a hash, which destroys essentially all the information, other than this is a hash of this, points actually have a little bit more structure to them that we can use, for example, for signatures and other things like this. And so you can pay trustlessly for signatures without having to hope that like that hash, the pre-image to that hash is the signature, or without requiring a ZKP. I mean, in a sense, you just have a ZKP, it's a free one. Like, you know, you learn nothing and you can just verify that that is what you think it is. And this works for more than just more than just like signatures. So first of all, I think this is just on its own a great thing. You can trustlessly pay for signatures if you're using PTLCs, Schnorr signatures, but signatures. Another thing that you can do is you can kind of, you can combine things. So like amps become better under PTLCs.
Listeners, yeah, because we have brought up amps a couple of times. So yes, amps are a way to use multiple different routes to combine together for a payment. So a normal Lightning payment happens. I send $10 to Bob and then Bob sends $10 to you. Well, maybe Bob only has $5 in his channel and only $5 in the channel with you. So we can't send a full 10. Well, we can send $5 through Bob to you, and then I can send another $5 here over on the left through Alice to you. And it's actually one payment. So that's amps. It's using Bob and
amps
and
stands
Alice
for atomic multipath payment. So there's multiple paths. And the key thing here is that I should only be able to claim once all of them have been set up. I should claim all of them, right? I don't want to claim just one of the fives and not the other one. I want to claim atomically both payments.
Yeah.
So atomic multipath payments or amps, there's kind of two ways that we have these right now on Lightning. One of them is called MPPs or multipath payments, which originally was called base amp, but I think MPP is a better name for it. And then more recently, I saw an announcement from Connor, I think. I can't pronounce his last name. It starts with an F. But anyway, I saw a tweet where they had implemented this.
From Nick?
Yeah, I think from, that one. That
like the, I think that middle K is like silent, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. I don't know. But
Yes. Well, so there's this other way of doing amps where, I should say, MPPs, we've had them for a while. They required very little changes, because there's nothing too atomic about them, which is why we renamed them to not have the word atomic in their name. They're just multipath payments. But essentially, in a multipath payment, what you do is you just send multiple payments using the same hash is what you do. And now the person who's receiving the payment, I mean, technically speaking, if the pre-image itself is economically valuable, they should wait until everything has been set up before claiming it, because if they claim any one payment, they reveal the pre-image over that route. But if it's just like a normal payment where it doesn't matter, you know, you could imagine a situation where like you run into some complication because the vendor like accepted some of the payments, but not all of them, and then didn't want to give you the service or something like this. So slight downside there where, essentially, it's not really atomic. Now, you can make it really atomic with amps, but this requires that the user generate kind of all of these different payments in a clever way, where the receiver gets some stuff in the onion, or they get some information on each payment being set up, and they can't claim any of them until they have all the information. And so this is the way that we do amps. These are actually atomic unless all payments have been set up. They cannot claim any of them because they are waiting on some secrets that they don't know yet. This has the downside though, that it must be spontaneous. So you can't invoice these. You can't have a vendor like reveal a secret to you. Everything is known by the payer and things are learned by the payee, by the vendor. So nothing can be learned under this scheme by the payer. So you don't have any proof of payment and there's no real invoice mechanism for these where the invoicer can like give you a hash or something like this. The hash is fully determined by the payer. So these certainly have use cases, especially for like, you could think of like, you know, subscriptions, you know, any place where you don't need an invoice, this works great. Any place you need an invoice and proof of payment and these kinds of things, these atomic multipath payments fall a bit short. So with PTLC based amps, also called D-log amps by some people, I think, D-log being the discrete log, which I've said so many times, right? Discrete log contracts, a discrete log is just the pre-image to a point. That is what a discrete log is in mathematical terms. So any place, if you hear me saying discrete logs, I try not to call pre-images of points discrete logs because I think that I don't want to confuse people, but some things are actually called like discrete logs by people. So like D-log amps, that's just like point pre-image amps. Just replace that in your head.
So basically it's a locking something to a secret that you don't know yet.
Yeah. So with, it's like a public key is a point and the discrete log of that public key is the private key or the number.
Okay.
Was used to generate it. So, with these D-log amps PTLC amps, if you prefer, which I do, then what you can do is you can actually like combine stuff that the payer generated with stuff that the payee generated, which you can't do with hashes, right? It's a complicated process with a bunch of zero knowledge proofs and some interaction in order to do this with hashes. But with PTLCs, you can actually get an invoice that has kind of like the point that vendor knows things about and that will act as proof of payment. Say it's a ticket to a concert, you know, whatever. Or a signature or something like this. And then the payer can still split it up into multiple payments using secrets that they know that are revealed as the payments get set up to the person getting paid. And then they reveal kind of this aggregate secret and then you subtract the stuff you know to get the stuff you don't know kind of scheme. So you essentially recover atomicity, invoiceability, and proof of payment. And you can still do it without invoices and just generate all the secrets yourself. But the point is now you have the option to learn something concurrent with having your payment go through. So this is another use case. Like points are better than hashes for all the reasons. And
so what's a real world scenario where the hash wouldn't work, but the point does in that scenario?
Yeah, I mean, so say that you wanted to have a scheme where you're selling tickets to a concert and how you do this is when someone comes and wants to buy a ticket from you, you give them an invoice, which has the hash of the ticket essentially. If and only if they pay, they should learn the pre-image. But say the tickets cost like $1,000 or something. I don't know. Maybe it's like to a museum or something. Yeah. Or a gallery. And then, you know, maybe it's not practical to expect, like if it's not such a super small amount, and even if it is, you want people to be able to use amps to pay for it. And if we wanted to do this today, you'd have to use MPPs. And once again, this doesn't work because not only does everybody along a single subpayment learn the pre-image to the hash, every single route that you use in your MPP, everyone learns the hash pre-image. So you can't treat that as a ticket. But using PTLC amps, you can actually invoice with that ticket point instead of a hash, the point of the ticket. And then if and only if a person completes all of their subpayments, you know, they can pay you with an amp or they can pay you not with an amp. The point is that it's kind of, you know, up to them in this world. You can invoice the same for either one.
So kind of in the current context, let's say in the way Lightning currently works, mm-hmm. like if I wanted to go to a website and get a concert ticket, if they try to use the secret of the payment as the ticket, then everybody I sent, I
routed through
to make that payment happen knows that secret. So they can't do that. What we have to do is I pay for it, and then they give me a ticket through a completely different avenue. They send it over email or something
they
like
can,
that.
They can like give you the ticket encrypted with the payment hash pre-image or something over some other channel
first,
or something like this.
And then you can unlock it.
Yeah, or they can, there's a couple other things you can do, but all of them require some third channel interaction, whatever.
Another way to send data, whereas in the other is—
And some extra information to do that with.
So, and in the other scenario where we're talking about the point time lock contracts, is that they can actually, as soon as they write me an invoice, that is the ticket.
Yeah.
Done. And all I have to do is prove that I was the other end of that invoice when I go to the thing. So the actual payment is the digital good.
Yes.
Rather than is the proof of ticket.
Exactly. Yes.
And
so
the same reason in our little routing scenario earlier of the wormhole attack, the same reason that Four doesn't know, even if they are number four and number two in that path, it's the same reason Four doesn't know that number two is related and can't figure out number three without knowing that piece of information. The same reason that that can't happen is the same reason they don't know the actual proof of the ticket in number one, because you are the only one that is number one and has that final piece of information.
Yes, exactly. So, I guess the ticket, I like to use it as an example, but it is a bit simplistic and it kind of doesn't show the full power of why we care about PTC. Because at the end of the day, like, so what if you're probably on a website anyway, if you're asking for an invoice, whatever, right? But the nicer thing here is that this is, once again, just another building block for building applications on top of Lightning. You have actual proof of payment that you can use in your applications for various things, and you can combine them and do all sorts of other things. So there's some more complicated schemes, for example, putting DLCs on Lightning via routes using PTLCs that require the combination of a bunch of points and proofs of payment in order to actually like get this to go through. So the key thing that you need in order to do DLCs over Lightning in a routed fashion is you need atomic multi-payment setup. I need to rename it because that's AMPS, but with a capital S. So I'll think of something better. But essentially, in a sense, what you need is you need, say in the super simple example where we're betting on the election and, you know, either I pay you one Bitcoin if the Democrats win, or you pay me one Bitcoin if the Republicans win, then what happens here is that what we could do over Lightning is we could just send each the other a payment over Lightning that was, let's say, like a PTLC, where the point was the anticipation for that Oracle signature. And so if you get that Oracle signature for that specific event, then you can claim that payment. Otherwise you can't, and it'll time out and go back to me, right? But we each set up one to each other with a different point, right? With the Democrat point and the Republican point. But the key thing here that's hard, so if we could do this, then that's it. That's all there is to it. We have a DLC set up routed over Lightning. And even the people along the routes, they don't know it's a DLC. It could be different people taking different sides of it, right? Essentially. They're just being used as Lightning infrastructure. We got to pay those fees. Those are HODL PTLCs. Once we get the fee stuff worked out to protect against spam and all that, it'll be priced in. So the problem that needs to be solved is we need to be able for me to set up a payment to you and for you to set up a payment to me, but where neither one of us can cheat the other one, right? Because it's like, who goes first, right? If I set up to you first, then like, well, darn, that's not good. Like, you're not going to set up to me, and vice versa. We get a free option, essentially. Yeah. That's a free option problem there. So one solution is that we can set up essentially one of these PTLC AMPs that where I pay you a Bitcoin, you pay me a Bitcoin, but that's not the end of the route. Then they both combine and hit some, what we call right now, a barrier escrow. So some third party, they don't know anything, but essentially, you can think of this as like almost all of the payments ended up as fees to you, and then like, you know, send them a couple sats over the Lightning network, right? And then they only once all of those payments are set up do they release and they go back. So there's a couple of things that you want out of these barrier escrows, right? You don't want them releasing some payments and not others. You know, you it does require a tiny bit of trust, but less than even in the DLC Oracle, I think, in part because it's fully incentivized. They know absolutely nothing. Like, there's so many use cases for these barrier escrows. They're literally just getting paid, right? Like, if they don't release some of them, they're just foregoing payments
nothing. They're just dropping out whatever their fee would have been.
And furthermore, you know, you could try and set up some reputation system or have some kind of way of proving fraud. It's hard to do, but I'm not sure that it's impossible. It's probably possible.
Yeah,
I hope.
So kind of the beauty.
Yeah.
The beauty of all of this stuff is that this is essentially going to enable, this is kind of like the Lightning Pool shadow chain stuff, like in the same, which we've talked about on the show quite a bit in previous episodes, is that this is multiple different avenues to do varying degrees of complexity and lack of even direct relationship for all sorts of, you know, potentially decentralized exchanges.
Yeah.
Options contracts that attach it to a broadcasted US dollar versus Bitcoin price. I mean, these could be massive tools in a financial system mm-hmm. that has no centers, that just has that, you know, you can use an Oracle in any damn country you want. You don't have to care whether the New York Stock Exchange is playing along, you know, like no giant licensing agreements or custodians that you have to worry about or that you have to fully trust. Like, this is really kind of opening this whole thing into whatever the hell you can write in code and you can put into a signature. We can do it non-custodially and in an open network, in an open market fashion, on a global scale.
Totally.
That's a big fucking deal. You know, that's huge.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is just amazing stuff.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, there's still a couple, you know, things that need to be smoothed out. Like, you know, decentralized matchmaking is probably one of the bigger problems that we'd love to see solved. And there are plenty of projects working on that, you know, like BISC already has some version of some solution going, and a bunch of other things do too. I'm not worried steps. That it won't work. I'm just saying, like, we're so early that it's very painful.
that's the long view of what's going on here.
Exactly. And
without these building blocks, that future isn't possible. These are the building blocks that will take us that next two steps forward to make those.
Yeah, things. And my hot take is that any solution to the Oracle problem makes Bitcoin able to do anything that any other, you know, protocol out there can do.
Yeah.
Like, any solution to the Oracle problem does the trick. And furthermore, any interesting contract requires an Oracle. So if you put those two things together, it's like, why wouldn't you use Bitcoin for these things?
Yeah.
Right. Like, if you need, right, unless you're like literally speculating on, I don't know, something weird, like something internal to a blockchain's contract or a blockchain state. Right. Like, if it's like, I'm speculating on the block height, what do you mean? I don't know. Unless you're doing something very pure, so to speak, like that, you need to bring in external data in order to do anything interesting. Right. A smart contract at the end of the day is just a contingent payment where the contingency can be like an arbitrary program or something like that. But the nice thing is, right, if you need to be able to rely on something external to the system, even if it's related to the system, right? If I could write an Oracle for the fee rate, and you would not really, or maybe there's some really clever way that I don't know about to represent, to somehow capture speculation of the fee rate inside of a Bitcoin transaction without an Oracle, but I don't think it's practical or maybe even possible. But even if it's like related to your system, you need some way of bringing metadata in, essentially, or data that isn't about your system even, in order to do anything interesting. And if you have to do that, well, then you need a solution to the Oracle problem. And if you have a solution to the Oracle problem, well, you can do anything you want, like as far as contracts are concerned. Like, you can just build arbitrarily, you know, interesting combinations of certain kinds of DLCs, match them in with oblivious escrows, which we'll have someday on top of oblivious oracles, where the escrows literally are just like running little virtual machines for you, and they don't even know what your contract's about, because like rather than using data that they validate, you give them like Oracle signatures in place of that data, like DLC Oracle signatures, right? So you, anyway, you have a bunch of these oblivious entities using some solution that is nice to the Oracle problem, and then you can execute anything you want on top of Bitcoin, where the only thing that goes on chain is just like some simple single pub key transactions. So this is like, it's not only the private solution, it's also the scalable solution, right? Like all of this happens off chain. Yeah. And once you have that, you can do like anything you want off chain, and it won't cost extra. And then you can move it all on Lightning, and then it won't cost like almost anything at all.
So it's both, it's the privacy solution, it's the scaling solution, and it's the write whatever you want into the smart contract solution.
Totally. Yeah. The first two, I think, are like super intertwined. It's really hard to get a scalable solution that isn't private. And this should tell you, when you see all these non-scalable solutions out there, they're probably not that private. Like if you use most like oracles out there on, you know, Ethereum or something, like everyone can see that you're calling that oracle for that specific piece of data. Like it's literally on the public ledger that you are calling this oracle. Not only can the oracle see it, everyone can see it, right? Like you don't want that. And yeah, so the scalable thing is going to be more private than the non-scalable thing. But then it just so happens that like, yeah, once you have a good solution to the oracle problem, like you can do pretty much anything you want. Like you don't need I guess like the high level is, you know, this thing that most Bitcoiners already know, which is like, you don't need your chain to do all this work for you. Like the chain should just be validating signatures.
Yeah.
You know,
who's the rightful owner and what's the money, you know, what's the monetary policy. That's what it needs to do. And we can do everything else off of it.
Exactly. Yes. And so, you know, what I think is the best solution that we have so far for the Oracle problem that's out there, being used, you know, it doesn't require more than that. So why would you build more than that into your system?
Yeah.
And so super bullish on DLCs. But yeah, I guess there's most people who I talk to, rightfully so, I think, are interested in kind of the things you can do with DLCs, you know, all these kind of financial contracts and all that stuff. But I, you know, the reason I got into DLCs is because they're this building block, just like PTLCs are, mm-hmm. just like all these other things. You know, once you have kind of these fundamental like Legos, you know, one of the Legos I hope comes out someday that I don't know too many people are working on is, I mentioned this oblivious escrows idea. It's very similar to a DLC, but where I believe it's called Smart Contracts Unchained. It was a mailing list post a couple of years ago by ZMNSCPXJ.
Okay.
It essentially spelled out how, like, an alternative to federations for executing contracts, federated sidechains and things like this. Yeah. I can send you a link to this as well, but essentially. The idea, or so in the super simple case where you just have a single escrow, which of course you can always add more, is you have these two parties, say me and you. And so let's do the same example, even though you wouldn't use it for this, you'd use DLCs. So say, you know, we're doing this election bet again, pretend DLCs don't exist. How it works in smart contracts on chained world is we write up a little program that says like, or we could even... Yeah, let's just do it the simple way. So you have an escrow, you have a 2 of 3 multi-sig on-chain where it's your key, my key, and a tweaked version of the escrow key where the escrow can't recognize that that's theirs unless we contact them with some extra information.
Okay.
So
we're using their key, but if we cooperate,
then we didn't really use them, right?
Like, okay, yeah.
I mean, we used them, but we never contacted them. We never asked them to do any computation. We never paid them.
Yeah.
Right. But if there ever is a disagreement, either one of us can go to this escrow. And what we do though, is we give them the signed contract, where the contract is just a program written in whatever programming language you want. You could do Solidity, but you'd probably end up doing something else like C++ or Java or Scala, or, you know, just write a program in a VM, or, you know, they're running a VM, say they're running like a Java virtual machine, you could write your program in Scala, send it over to them. We've both signed it is the first thing. So, right, we're trusting them to validate the signatures that we've made of this contract, that they match the pup keys on the transaction, and then they run to see what the output is, and then they sign a transaction that spends that 2 of 3 to how it should go according to the program. And then, you know, one of the two other parties is going to sign that as well. And then it's just a 2 of 3. So the only thing on chain is a 2 of 3, which, by the way, once we have Taproot, the cooperative spend is just going to be that Taproot, right? That 2 of 2 between me and you. And then we'll have some masked branches for me and the escrow and you and the escrow. So at the end of the day, and those are both also just single pub keys. So under Taproot, this is just single pub key spend. And ideally, what happens is, but the thing is, you can literally write any contract in any language here, right? Like, this is like, forget Turing complete, like choose your Turing machine, right? Like, you pick the language that you want, so long as, you know, you have a set of escrows that, you know that language. And, you know, you can use like 3 of 5, 5 of 7, you know, any
variation, yeah.
Right. Yeah, you can even do that with like some combinations instead of having giant masts, but you can also do it using giant masts if you want. But yeah, at the end of the day, if both me and you agree, we just sign it and, you know, execute. Otherwise, we have these other escrows run the programs that we both agreed to by signing, and then sign their pieces. And I think the key thing here is, if this is done right, you want the actual programs to not reveal what your actual contract is doing. So as I mentioned, you replace data with Oracle signatures, right?
Gotcha. So the details of what's going on is still never even revealed.
They're literally just executing state machine changes in a Turing machine, if you want to think about this super high level. But yeah, I mean, more practically, they're just executing Java programs, and these Java programs spit out transactions. And it's hard to analyze these Java programs. They don't like have stuff in them. And then, but this interops super well with DLCs, because if you have a DLC ecosystem, now you can replace all of your data with just DLC Oracle signatures and move on from there. But you can also do arbitrary computation if you wanted to. Now, I haven't thought of too many interesting use cases, because so much is just covered by DLCs, and you can do so
get
much
that
already.
First and most of it dealt with. Yeah.
I do have a couple use cases that I have come up with that where it's like, oh, it'd be nice to do this, and I can't just with oracles. You know, oracles can cover the data pieces of it, but at the end of the day, I want to do some computation, and I don't want to really use like an MPC, which is this multi-party computation cryptography. You know, it's like super heavy machinery. You don't want to touch that stuff. That could go wrong very easily. You know, the easier solution is just like, you know, write up a program. I'm hoping that, you know, an ecosystem, just like an Oracle ecosystem, pops up. You get this escrow smart contracts unchained escrow ecosystem pop up. This is like super long term. I don't think anyone's actually working on smart contracts unchained right now. In my mind, like, once DLCs are great, maybe that's the next thing I work on. But yeah. Yeah, I guess
maybe get you to build it.
Yeah, no, but that's another building block that's out there. But I think this is actually the best way to explain to someone that if you have a solution to the Oracle problem, then you can do anything, because literally with smart contracts unchained, once you have a solution to the Oracle problem, or the escrow problem in this case, oracles and escrows are very similar. You can literally write any program you want in any language you want and execute it on Bitcoin with nothing going on chain other than single pub key spends, right? You That's can literally amazing. Do anything.
So if you happen to be running a blockchain whose sole value is the fact that you have, you know, a whole bunch more scripts than Bitcoin, that really doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, and furthermore, I mean, if you're on some other chain, I'm not like, I think that they should be using DLCs and smart contracts on chain.
Certainly,
like, you know,
it's a better system.
I have not taken the time, you know, as I mentioned, I'm class of 2018. I haven't been around that long. I have not taken the time to go look at other projects and judge whether or not they have any merit. So, and I don't really have the time to or plan to anytime soon. But, you know, if you're working on another project, use DLCs instead of like on-chain Oracle calls. Why wouldn't you do this? This is so much better. Like, we're building the ecosystem, you can use it too. I don't care. Like, yeah, this is like the right way to do it. And so, you know, if you have some reason to be using something other than Bitcoin, well, you should still be using DLCs and all these other kind of ideas as well.
Well, I hate to close this out because I could probably just tear at your brain for another 3 hours. But I'm about 2 minutes away from another call.
Gotcha.
Where should people go to figure out more about this?
Yes.
And what should they be most excited about?
Yeah. Well, hopefully within 6 months, probably less, we'll have a V0 tag of the DLC specification and multiple implementations that work for that. To read more about this stuff, there's the Shirdbits blog at shirdbits.com/blog. There's the DLC spec repo, which will be in the show notes, which also links out to a bunch of resources of its own, including the white paper and other things like that. If you're interested in contributing, you know, look around there, be a fly on the wall at the next spec meeting. Also PTLC stuff. Kind of, most of the things I talked about, I've written about as well on the Shirdbits blog. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Dude, thank you so much.
Totally.
I'll make sure, drop me all of those links so we can have those in the show notes, and I'll send everybody your way. Oh, and drop awesome. Your Twitter tag too.
At Nco. Is it Ncohen or Nadav Cohen? One sec. I don't use Twitter all that much. I am there. You can reach me there, but I don't use it enough to actually know what my handle is. One second. It's Nadav_Cohen with a K.
I'll have it
N Cohen on GitHub, which is where I live, but I'm Nadav Cohen on Twitter. It's been really fun, and you know, I obviously could talk about this all day, so if you ever want to talk more about it, let me know.
Yeah, dude, when we're getting a V0, I'll probably have you back on, and we'll dive back into it.
Yeah, we can talk about how multi-oracle numeric contracts work or something maybe more interesting.
Awesome, man. Dude, sure. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It's been awesome. You have got to read everything on the Shirdbits blog if you aren't already. And follow Nadav Cohen, that's NADAV_KOHEN on Twitter. These guys really are building just some amazing, amazing things for Bitcoin, and it's going to be really incredible to follow. If you want to support Bitcoin Audible and help keep this show alive, subscribe first and foremost, so you can learn everything about Bitcoin. Spreading the good word and knowing how to defeat the ignorant FUD out there, particularly in the bull runs, is your first line of defense. This is the place where you will learn everything you need to defeat all of the Bitcoin FUD, Bitcoin Audible. And you can also become one of the anointed in my Audionaut group, where we hang out and talk about Bitcoin and play with the technical stuff and set up nodes, all sorts of crazy stuff. And all you have to do is donate to the show in any fashion at guyswan.com at the bottom of the page. If you just send Bitcoin or Lightning, just shoot me the transaction details. Or of course, just become a patron. That's also right at the bottom of that page, as little as $1 a month, and you automatically get an invite. So a huge, huge thank you to everyone who has. But you know, donating money or sats, that's a tall order sometimes. And if you want to hold on to those, you can always share this show out with everyone you know interested in Bitcoin. This is where they will learn it all. Bitcoin Audible. And one final thank you to our wonderful sponsors, the Bitbox O2 hardware wallet and the Level.co mobile banking services and no fee exchange. You can find basically everything at guyswann.com. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you are listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.